Good afternoon, good morning, good night, depends upon where you are in the world. Where I'm at is Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Training Center in Miami, Florida. And my name is Bill Gustin, the oldest man in the room, a 48-year veteran of the fire service, began in the Chicago area. But today we have a surprise, kind of a treat. I asked my dear friend, Captain Enrique Pereira.
Hello, everybody.
Who has is actually a master of two disciplines, technical rescue and hazardous materials. And he teaches both in confined space rescue, teaches both for the IAFF with other firefighters or fire officers from around the country. So the topic today is pre-fire planning. And I asked Enrique to talk about one of the most vulnerable, if not the most vulnerable buildings that we could find in our jurisdiction, which would be buildings under construction. Now, I'll add to that in deference to and give credit to Captain Mike Dugan, buildings undergoing abatement, such as asbestos, can also get you into trouble. So, but before that, and we finish up our introductions here, Enrique participated in a very involved, protracted technical rescue this morning involving a tractor trailer. And it looks like they used every tool in the toolbox. So, Clark, can you just a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself.
Yes, sir. As always, Clark Lamping from Clark County, Nevada, Las Vegas area. Happy to be here. Happy that you invite me every week. Even though I have nothing to say, you keep inviting me. So I'm great. I'm just going to sit here and be the happy smiley face. I'm currently assigned to Station 38, which is in the south side of the Las Vegas Valley. We share a border with Henderson Fire Department. Been on the job for almost 23 years now, been a captain for 11 years, used to be on the technical rescue team, so I have some questions for Enrique. I'm going to be listening very carefully to what he had to do today, and looking forward to participating. I've got some good information on how we in Clark County pre-planned all of our high-rise buildings and catalog that information so we can grab that information quickly and easily in a timely manner. So,
okay. Looks like we have another panelist joining us. His name is Kelly Shaw. Hey, Kelly, how you doing there, Kelly Shaw?
Give him my alias to my wife sometimes.
All right, everybody. How you guys doing? Dan, real quick, tell everybody who you are, where you come from.
Dan Shaw, I'm Deputy Chief with Fairfax County Fire and Rescue and part of Traditions Training. And glad to join another conversation with these
Okay, a couple of shout outs. Captain Mike D. Dugan is undergoing some physical today, so he can't make it. And Mike has to get a lot of physicals because he worked so much time, spent so much time at Ground Zero. And they have to watch those guys' health very carefully. I want to shout out to Daryl Liggins, who's not here today. He's on duty protecting the citizens of Oakland, California. Sam Hiddle, I assume, is protecting the citizens of Wichita, Kansas. And Jason Hovelman, who is supervising his personnel on the Florissant Valley Fire Protection District in the St. Louis area with getting their COVID vaccines. So, another shout out to my friends at Key Hose. That's keyhose.com. That would be Mark Lighthill and Dan. His name escapes me right now, but it'll come to me. Used to be a lieutenant on engine or captain engine 10 in DC. But his name will come to me in a moment. Remember, I'm old, so I have an excuse to forget people's names. Would you say your name was?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Julio.
Yeah.
Julio.
All right. So, hey, we use Key Hose every day at this academy. And that's the true test of a fire hose. It's put in the hands of recruits where they're dragging it across asphalt and over window sills for hours each day. And then if in the Miami area, it's laying out in the sun. And as much as we're not supposed to do it, I probably shouldn't say this, we could void our warranty. Mm-hmm. We actually let the hose lay out there and be attacked by the ultraviolet sun. So, which, by the way, this what's happened to me and what happens to Enrique.
Right.
See, it's not our fault. It was the ultraviolet light. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, hey, another shout out to my dear friend, Lieutenant, soon to be Captain Jimmy Davis of the Chicago Fire Department. He got the word that he will be promoted to captain very soon. He's in the training division, and for the time being, he will stay in the training division. About next month, looking ahead, was the suggestion of Daryl Liggins that we look at the use and the capabilities of the portable master stream device. Without mentioning any brand names, these are the small monitors with a single 2.5-inch inlet you supply with either 2.5 or 3-inch hose. Coincidentally, Oakland and Chicago got Homeland Security grants and equipped each of their engines with the RAM, or that I gave that brand away. They're all good, and they all have the capabilities of about 400 gallons a minute, but that's going to be for next month. Again, if you're looking to replace your hose, consider Key. You'll never go wrong with Key hose. Enrique, my brother,
sir,
you want to talk about the incident that I'm going to give you center stage.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. So just a little bit myself, I'm in charge of the technical rescue program for Miami-Dade. I was a structural engineer before I got in the department, and then I decided to do the fun stuff as opposed to the engineering stuff. So we had an incident this morning with a tractor trailer that rolled off one of our highways onto an embankment. We have a rotator program that includes a 50-ton Jerr-Dan rotator, so we put that to use. The extrication went on for about 3 hours. We ended up doing a modified dash roll on the cab of the truck, but we wouldn't have been able to get to him had it not been for the rotator and the fact that we were to lift and rotate the cab enough to get access to the patient. So I'm sure everyone here has had incidents like that. So we established our rotator program about 4 years ago after many incidents where we had to rely on the private industry, that just there's too much of time delay in getting the private industry to respond. And so far, the rescue rotator is credited with about 8 saves, where a life would not have been saved without the rotator. And I have pictures that I could send to anyone that wants to see how we did it. So about 3 hours of extrication and every tool in the book, from the helicopter to the 4 technical rescue units and about 6 or 7 other fire units. Pretty well involved.
Well, what fireman does not like to see pictures?
Right. Hold on. So let me see if I can get them going.
We're going to go ahead and get these pictures going.
Hey, Enrique.
Yes, sir.
What was the truck hauling?
Fruits and vegetables.
Okay.
Fully loaded.
Fully loaded reefer truck?
Yeah, and the trailer came apart enough where they couldn't lift the trailer without it collapsing further.
Okay. And what exactly, how exactly did you incorporate the rotator? Stabilization or lifting or what?
A little bit of both. So our standard practice is stabilization first with the rotator and then lift second. So this time we did the stabilization, and then when the first private contractor showed up with their rotator, they handled lift, we just rotated the cab. We didn't really lift it, we just rotated it slightly. So we've been working really well together over the last couple of years. We had to establish a relationship where we're not trying to take their business. We don't tow, we don't recover, we just stabilize and lift for rescue, and then we turn it over to the private industry. So
Enrique, wouldn't you say a lot of these are two wrecker operations anyway?
Yeah, the weight of these trucks nowadays, where they can approach 120,000 pounds, there's difficult to lift with just one truck. Let me see if I can get some good pictures.
Clark, we're gonna ask you to let us know if you're seeing the pictures clearly. Okay.
All right.
There's the tractor trailer on its side off the embankment. The guys are ready.
Back it off just a little, Enrique. All right.
Yeah. And I can send you guys these pictures. So just to give you a layout of how the truck was sitting.
Is it on? What side is it on, Enrique? Driver or passenger?
Driver's side.
Driver's side. And what was the extent of the entrapment? Dash collapsed?
No, his legs wrapped between the steering column and the essentially the A-post of the truck. But the A-post of these trucks incorporates a grab bar, a solid steel grab bar, so it's not as easy to move the A-post. But we couldn't get to the A-post until we lifted the truck enough to get visuals on that. So we displaced the steering column, we cut the steering column, and then we basically did a modified dash roll on that on the A-post driver's side.
With what equipment, Enrique? Use the spreaders, use chains, and pull it. What was the operation?
We use a little bit of everything. So displacing the steering column was just a ratchet come along. That's okay. How we got that done. Then the spreaders and cutters to remove material, ramps to do the modified roll, and then some buttresses to support the sleeper section of the cab. So our experience with these vehicles is the cab part is steel and behaves a lot like a car does when you cut pieces away. But that sleeper cab is very loose. It moves and breaks away very easily. So we supported that. And then we started cutting the entire roof line, all the A-post, all the way down to the A-pillar. And that's where we did the roll. Let's even get a picture of that.
Go ahead. Shoot
right there. There's a lot. So this started in the middle of the night. So it was 5 in the morning. So not very good pictures. We have one here. I can rotate it here. So this is a little bit of the driver's side that we had access to. This is before we rotated the cab upward and got basically underneath the cab and finished off the extrication. Huh. A lot of good people in the right places really what it accounted for.
And you are in charge of the whole program, all four stations, Enrique?
Sorry?
You're in charge of the whole technical rescue program?
Yeah, I'm basically the money spender. They need stuff, and we get them stuff. Then we provide all the training. We have a separate technical rescue program and a rotator program. So they get one certification, and then they move on to the second one. Throughout the year, we provide recurrent training. So we do about 200 hours of recurrent training with the on-duty units, and then we do the certification training as they come into the program.
Anything with the rotator here, operator?
Yeah, right here.
Okay, there's one. Okay, yeah.
Let me get Ricky's pictures up. He's got better ones.
Okay. You know, Ricky Clark, Ricky Stevens was there as well. And Ricky is a very accomplished photographer. So we're going to
be on the cover of Fire Engineering next month, Enrique.
What's that?
If Ricky Stevens is on the scene, you'll be on the cover of Fire Engineering next month.
He does have some skills. He actually put together a video montage in like 5 minutes. Including blocking out, you know, the faces of the patients and things like that. It's just very slow. There
it goes. Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That I think that pretty much captures everything that was going on. Yeah, that's a good one, Enrique.
So it's hard to tell, but the silver boom is our rotator. The black boom is the private contractor. So we've done enough training with them. With those private guys that they know our terminology and they know our limitations. And, you know, we really do rely on them a lot for knowledge and things like that. I can send anyone interested in
a couple more.
Yeah. And more information on how to work with your local rotators, wrecker guys. I can send you stuff like that. They're a great bunch of folks. They're professionals. They've been doing rotator work for many years. You don't find a single rookie driving those apparatus. So this is towards the end. Since we had a pretty steep embankment, probably about 60 degrees, we set up a low angle rope ops. He's in the Stokes basket using a patient tie-in. We had a 4-to-1 set up, and we just did a low angle haul up from the truck up to the road.
Enrique, did you bring out a trauma surgeon?
Yeah, we had the surgeon there with the amputation kit. So our protocol is if the entrapment's more than 20 minutes, we start the surgeon from our trauma center, and they bring everything they need to do the amputation. Luckily, not necessary here.
Okay. All right.
That's heads up, too. Heads up.
Yeah.
I was on an extrication once, just a single vehicle, high speed into a wall, and Enrique, the floorboard – just a single driver in the vehicle, the floorboard actually came up like a wave and crushed down on the driver's left foot. So like a clamshell, completely crushed. And we worked, and because of the position of his legs, we had so much trouble getting in there and trying to open that up. Mm-hmm. I was actually considering using the Sawzall because he was spiraling down. He was dying. He was dying. And I was considering using the Sawzall to amputate the leg in the field. No surgery or anything. And I actually kind of tongue-in-cheek asked the question in the EMS division, hey, what do you guys think about this? And the answer was, don't ever use a Sawzall to cut someone's leg off on scene. Ever, no matter what. Don't ever do that. I said, okay.
Okay. Well, that's what we do. We have a 16-inch stainless steel blade that goes with our Sawzall. The last amputation we did was at the, we had a building collapse here about 5 years ago. We had to do the amputation just below the pelvis. So it was very traumatic. But there's, the surgeons will tell you there's no clean way to do it. So it really doesn't matter the tool that's being used. It's more about just getting it done rapidly. And the greater part of the operation is the setup, the sedation of the patient, the agreement with the doctor that we're at that point where only amputation is going to save the life. And then you can't give up after the amputation because you have to try to recover the limbs so that they can reattach the limbs. So luckily we work a lot with our trauma surgeon to, you know, have these things come out successfully, even though it is traumatic.
Okay, we're going to go to, did you, any more on this operation?
No.
Okay. If anything else comes to mind, you know, this is an informal discussion here. So just chime right in. Chief Dan Shaw, the topic this month is the pre-fire planning. Specifically, how does your department gather that information and how do they access it, like with an MCU or a booklet or whatever, and how you use it? So, Dan, you could give us a little idea how Fairfax County handles their pre-fire intelligence.
Well, so probably like most fire departments, we realize how good or bad our system is when we have a fire and then we don't have that information and go, God, it'd have been great to have that. So I think we suffer like many of the fire departments in the country of not having a very robust program. And routinely prior to, I'd probably say this probably about 2 years ago, it was relied upon individual companies. And so they would go out and do pre-fire planning. Because we're very fortunate in an aspect that, you know, we have an entire civilian section that does our fire inspections. It's run by uniform members, and that's part of like the inspection of buildings. It's also the pre-fire inspections. It's building inspections, things of that nature. So we routinely relied upon the companies to go out, identify the target hazards within their area, and then fill out essentially an informational document and return it every year and do it. And then during their station inspection, which the ops deputies perform, you would check those. But that system became very, very antiquated. As a command officer, you would have to go to the first two pieces of apparatus and pull out that book and see if you could find any information on it. So it really was behind the eight ball. We had a lot of really good people working on that process for us to try to figure out the best path going forward. And after several years, it really was not any good process out there that worked with it in our system, and it was sustainable. Until probably last year, probably 2019, we started using a third-party app, FirstDo. It's been fantastic. It's all run by an iPad. As the companies go out and they're running calls, they can open up the iPad right there. They can update all the information as they see fit. Whether it's a single family dwelling, all the way up to a large target hazard. And then any one of us who goes in that call, because that's also a dispatching software. So it allows us to see the call come up, the call comes up, you can see what the supplements are, just like you would in your CAT or your MCT. And then if our personnel put in the information, it blends what is in the permits, when they file the permit, to tell you the basic information of the structure. But then also of our personnel putting additional information that's very pertinent, specific, and relevant to what we do, we can see that without having to go to a rig and get a piece of paper. Everything is seamless on technology. So we're still vetting that.
You bring out a very important point. You mentioned the permitting process, permits. Do you get that from your building department? In other words, is a construction project or a refurb project flagged where it's brought to your attention?
So, I mean, it's no secret. You know, we had a $50 million structure 750,000 square feet burned, and that was under construction. And it really exposes some of the disconnect that happens between being such a large organization and not having really seamless communication between a civilian side that does permits and occupancy, things of that nature, to what comes to us, and then within the fire rescue department, our uniform side. So we're really, really fortunate is that we have a battalion chief dedicated to that aspect of a uniform member who oversees some of that, and then a deputy in that position. So they know what language we speak, they know what we're looking for, but he's one person in a county with almost 1.5 million people and 400 square miles. So we really do rely upon the companies, and you know that Polk Street fire we had, you know, what came out of that is the importance of us having this NFPA 241 compliance officer to make sure that these buildings under construction, demolition, or renovation are complying with the code. And because we don't expect our personnel to know all the NFPA regulations, they can call this resource and find out, hey, this doesn't look right to me. Like that FDC is not hooked up. I don't think that's right. Or there's not sprinklers in said spot they're supposed to be. So now we have that resource as a result of that large lost fire to be able to go and say, hey, this is something we have to help our personnel on the street, to help with that relationship you're talking about, Bill, is understanding when permits change and occupancy types change, our personnel need to know.
Dan,
are you guys required to inspect just regular operating businesses, and do the line firefighters, who captures the information?
So we don't do any inspections. We're not required by it. That's why we have the civilian fire inspectors to take care of them for us. But the loss in that is to what I think you're alluding to, Clark, is that our personnel don't get out in the buildings and have to, you know, do these inspections per se. What it really comes down to is more of the expectation from like my position down to the battalion chiefs, to the captains of, hey, you got to take the words of my good friend, Larry Schultz, you have to know your building stock. You have to know these buildings before you go into them. So we see more of that culture change of where our personnel take advantage of the medical locals and the fire alarms, or just, you know, they're driving the streets and learning the buildings to walk through these buildings and have conversations about what are we looking for? You know, what specifically are we looking for? Whether it's a high rise and where the fire control room is, or commercial occupancies, where all the utilities are, what the layout is, what's the difference in the front of the store, the back of the store, access points, all those things, you know, we're looking for. But as for a formal program, no, we're still kind of working through that to make sure we have something that's sustainable and relevant to what we want.
Okay. Clark, I was very impressed when I visited your department with your pre-fire planning intelligence. One thing that sticks in my mind is that laminated sheet you put on the engineer's compartment door that has the demand pressure for, I'm going to guess, every large high-rise hotel and casino on the Las Vegas Strip, like Caesar's Palace was there, MGM Grand, and so on. That was one heck of an undertaking, Clark. Now, how did you get that information? Was it flow tests? Did you do the flow test? Did you witness the flow test? Does it come from the pump test documents? Did it come from the plants? How did you arrive at all those pressures?
Unfortunately, Captain Gustin, that some of these buildings on the Las Vegas Strip are worth, you know, $100 million, some of them close to $1 billion. And so they're very hesitant on letting us show up and flow test their systems, because you're going, you know, as good as I do, we're going to break something. We're going to break something. Sure. And they obviously don't want that happening. They don't want the water damage. So the answer about 99% of the time is when we ask to flow test the building, they tell us absolutely not. So that information was derived from the plans and the chief engineer. We met with, when I say we had a really heads up battalion chief who actually made this, that document you saw, Captain Gustin, comes from the executive fire officer. It was one of his papers for his executive fire officer degree. And that was very knowledgeable guy. He met with every single head engineer of every single property, and he got that information from the plans. But again, sat down with them and talked about everything and mapped. And not only that document, Captain Gustin, but also, you know, we have multiple standpipes feeding different parts of the buildings. So our pre-plans for the high-rise hotels, which is our bread and butter, which is the biggest, most expensive properties we have in Las Vegas, some of those pre-plans are 7 pages long. With one page, you'll have elevators. One page, you'll have standpipes. One page, you'll have hookups. One page, you'll have air movement systems. So they're very, very complicated buildings, and it's almost too much information. You know, so if I'm pulling up, I used to work on Las Vegas Boulevard, and I could be in my first in. I could be in any one of my first ins in about 90 seconds. I don't have time to turn out to get my radio on and sort through 7 pages of information looking for the information I need. So what we do, Cap, is when we are very, very familiar with our buildings because we are in them all of the time for medical calls, all of the time for medical calls. And every single time, no matter what time of the day it is, we have a little Q&A when we're walking down the halls. Where's the fire command center? How many standpipes are in this building? How many elevators in this building? And, you know, with the medical bags on your back, walking down these halls half asleep, we constantly have to be thinking about what building are we in? Where are we in this building? What floor are we on? What wing are we in? Just make sure we maintain situational awareness.
Great. We're just about at a halfway point here. So I want to just give a shout out to another friend. I forgot his name, but I know a lot of people. So when they get, I'm old.
It's okay.
White Juan?
Julio.
Julio. Okay. Julio. All right. Julio. Julio. Dave Hibben. Dave Hibben from formerly from DC. I think he was on Engine 10. By the way, Dan, do you know Dan Shaw? Do you know Dave Hibben?
I do not.
All right. He came from DC Engine 10, which I think is keeps themselves fairly busy.
Yeah, they tend
and
to.
He is now a salesperson for Key Hose, and he's also an instructor because there are certain properties of Key Hose in terms of its dynamics, the way that it resists kinks, that it might require a little bit of a change of your people's skill sets, which is a good thing. It's a good thing. So. And just the way to configure it. And Dan brings a lifetime of experience on a very busy fire department and knows what works and what doesn't work. Okay, now, Enrique.
Sir.
How about we talk about when a building is most vulnerable?
Okay.
Obviously, Dan, Chief Dan, had a sandwich. I don't want to say what was on it, but it was definitely a sandwich, and it was a supersized sandwich. Before you start, can you tell us a little bit about this big sandwich that your department ate?
Yeah, sure. So it was the typical podium style or Texas donut you see, which is residential, lightweight residential built over commercial. So one story commercial, lower level, 4 to 5 to 6 stories of lightweight wood construction on the upper floors. As we learned in this incident, is so the fire started and some workers were working there, started in the trash chute, came up into the upper floors. When the first units got there, what they could see looked like fire showing from a few windows, and all this is under construction. So not one stitch of drywall, no interior walls, just 700,000 square feet plus of just open lumber. And so they, what they saw was relatively not a huge amount of fire, but it quickly grew. As you know, we always preach in every class we ever do is that, you know, we can have the best laid plans, but the fire always gets a vote. And today the fire was not assimilated to our manuals. So it did its thing. The end result, it ended up taking, the 5 buildings, which were these residential over commercial, 14 townhouses under construction, and about another 10 to 15 buildings were damaged. And we were very, very lucky. I mean, a lot of hard work and effort put into it by all the people who were there. That did not go to any of the occupied buildings. But the big thing we learned out of this is that, you know, when you learn more and more about the codes, there's nothing that says that these buildings had to be in varying states of construction to hope to slow fire. Yeah, and I would, you know, without having any engineering background, say if we had half that structure that had drywall in it, that perhaps would have given us enough time and enough of a break that we could have got, you know, apparatus in the right position and water supply taken care of to perhaps make a better fight on this. But because it was just an open lumber yard, it just walked the dog all the way through these structures and communicated from, you know, structure to structure to structure.
Enrique, you have a background in construction and engineering. Mm-hmm. And actually, let's talk about why I asked you to be on. I'm on a SOP committee, and we were, our business of the day and all of the last year has been revising our high-rise SOP. And Enrique is not on the committee, but he sat in, and we started talking about buildings under construction because that is a part of the high-rise SOP. And kudos to you, Dan, because I know that you had a hand in the Northern Virginia regional high-rise SOP, correct?
The operations manuals. Yep.
Yes, yes. Which I plagiared the doggy doo doo out of for ours.
Please do.
I was very impressed with his knowledge of construction sites and what we need to be looking for when we're responding for pre-fire planning and actual incidents. So I'm going to let you take it for. Go ahead, take it as long as you want it. Okay.
Yeah, we don't have an SOP either dealing with the buildings under construction. The county, luckily, we don't have any wood high rises. We do have a lot of the taxpayers like you described with the commercial at the bottom and everything else at top. Over the last 10 years, they've added even more to the structures where there's commercial, office, and then at the very top, you have residential. So they're trying to keep people from traveling. So our experience with the construction fires is just like the one in Virginia started. It's just always debris. Normally it's built up debris on a particular floor, and it's something as simple as a cigarette butt or something like that, lighting it off. So it's up to the incident commander to keep his units in check and get a good understanding of where the fire is going before they commit any resources. So us being a concrete loving city, we have issues with shoring. So a lot of the structures as they're going up have to be temporarily shored until the concrete can support itself. And we have had catastrophic failures. The city of Miami's had some catastrophic failures when that shoring burns and the, you know, uncured concrete comes crashing down. Luckily, they haven't lost anybody. But some simple tactics include, again, just critical that they understand where the fire is. It might just be a small debris pile, just creating a lot of smoke, or it could be some kind of temporary shoring. If it's a temporary shoring that's affected, it's a defensive fire in every way, shape, or form. Once you lose a floor in heavy construction, there's a good chance you're going to lose several other floors in the process. So that has to be built into any SOP or incident command process. Stairwells, just about all the building codes require the stairwells to be 4-hour rated, 2 to 4-hour rating, depending on where you're at. So if they're going to fight fire, usually out of the stairwell is going to be their best bet. That's going to provide them protection because the building's under construction. It's not partitioned yet. They may get good stream reach from that landing of that stairwell to get some knockdown and get a better idea of what's burning. So those are just some
Enrique, good tips. During construction, the stairway is required to be enclosed as the building goes up?
It's here we use stairwells. The walls of the stairwell here are usually used to resist the wind loadings that we have during a hurricane. So our stairs will be enclosed. And that's not the symbol. That's not same in all places. In some cases, they'll build the casing of the stairwell, and then when the building's done, they'll actually put the stairs in the casing. They'll build the stairs with either prefab metal sections or stuff like that. But here, for the most part, our stairwells are reinforced concrete.
And could you speak about the construction standpipe?
Sure. So if you guys get a chance and encourage your units to go to the sites as the buildings are going up so they can see how the standpipe comes together. The standpipe is usually snaked from an upper story down to a lower story, and then the sections of pipe are connected with just simple clamps. So depending on your building code, the standpipe may only reach maybe 4 to 6 floors below the last finished floor. So you could still have a significant height before with no standpipe. Other issues that come up. So as the standpipe is being assembled, the very top section of pipe will be just open pipe. So they have to cap that open pipe to have any kind of pressure build up in the standpipe. So your units would have to check that cap is in place at the very highest level of the standpipe. So that then the question comes along is, do they have to bypass the fire floor to find that cap? That's a question that you have to answer as a department. Normally, you don't want to send crews above the fire floor, especially on something that's under construction. But if that cap is not in place at the top of the pipe, you're not going to develop any pressure in the standpipe. Also, every valve on each landing has to be checked that it's closed. When they install these things, they don't really close them or open them. They just thread them in place, and the plumber moves on to the next floor. So someone would have to go to each landing and make sure that those valves are closed before you commit to using the standpipe. Depending on the type of building, usually when they're above 10 stories, if they have a pump that's designed that's going to go into that building, they may have already established the fire pump, but they may not be able to use it while the floors are still under construction. That's where the pre-planning of the construction site comes in. Your crews have to visit those construction sites maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, ask these questions. How high does the standpipe go? Is there a fire pump in place? Maybe the most critical for this is, where's the FTC? Because in construction, they can move the FTC wherever they need to during the process. Most contractors will try to keep the FTC close to a major road and close to a hydrant, but it's not a requirement. It's just they know why the FTC is being put, so they'll try to do the best they can. With a little bit of input from the local unit, they may be able to place the FTC where it would be most beneficial to the crew. So visiting these sites is crucial to safety. There's so much things the crews will learn talking to these contractors. Lastly, on the buck hoist issue, so if it's got a construction elevator, they're more than capable of taking people and equipment. The key here is getting the thing started. So if the construction site doesn't go on 24 hours, you'd have to have some pre-plan on where the breaker's at, how to turn the breaker on. Now, some of these elevators are not like an elevator with a button. They're not indexed to a given floor. They have a rheostat. They got to put someone in there that just, you know, up and down, and they line up the buck hoist with a given floor, and that's how the operation takes place. If your crews aren't comfortable doing that or haven't been trained, then the buck hoist may not be the quickest option until you get someone there that knows how to operate.
But
that.
Enrique, you're comfortable.
Yeah.
Okay, now you have a construction background.
Right. It wouldn't take much except just getting with the contractor and having a discussion on how the buck hoist works. And I don't think any contractor would be against the units using it if it's after hours and there's a fire. They want you to save the building. So they'll give you all the training that you want. The construction crane, the tower cranes are also an option. Pretty much a tower crane can put material near every floor in the building with different pieces of equipment. So it's absolutely a go-to for whether it's a medical call or a technical rescue call, they're there. If you do some pre-fire planning, the most important person on the construction site is going to be the construction site supervisor. They don't call them foremen anymore. They call them usually just supervisors or their safety officer, because they have a radio that talks to everyone on the construction site, and they can mobilize everyone on the construction site for your operations. So those are just some things that you could determine these things just with a visit to the construction site. It wouldn't take anything too formal.
Now, for instance, New York City, Enrique, when the building's under construction, it has to be under compressed air. It has to be pressurized with air. And if a valve is opened or a clamp is not in place, plug is not in place, that should initiate a supervisory alarm, I think. But it is received at a central station like ADT. And because we do not have freezing weather here, at what point do we require them to have water in the standpipe? Not necessarily to supply a hose line, but to detect leaks and open valves.
The only time they'll be functioning here is once a floor is occupied by the public. So depending on the height of the structure, we just had the tallest post-tension structure finished. It's 85 stories. So they had occupants at 20 stories, even though the rest of the building was still going up. So there they would have had a functioning standpipe up until then. They don't have to have a functioning FT standpipe or sprinkler system until they're done.
Okay, but so how many construction standpipes can we count on?
Probably just one. So during construction, they'll just establish one working standpipe. Again, you'd have to check that with the contractor. If he's very proactive or there's a very fast-moving project, there may be multiple standpipes that are operating or operable at a given time.
Clark, before we went on online here, we had a discussion about using the construction standpipe. Can you relay your opinions, both from a firefighting and also a technical rescue aspect?
I don't think it was a construction standpipe, Cap. It was the elevator. It was the elevator.
Yeah, the buck hoist. Yes.
Yeah. And in Las Vegas, our construction projects typically run 24 hours a day. So we always have people on on site. As far as my department goes, we don't have any written policies, and we are not trained, and we're not encouraged to train on how to use the exterior elevator. I personally would have no problem using the elevator, because what's our other option? This is a high-rise building. You expect guys to come up a full complement of high-rise firefighting equipment, 60, 70 floors? No one's going to be able to do that, except maybe Pat Brown of the FDNY. And if anyone does actually make it, no one's going to be in any condition to fight any fire. So if we have that resource available, absolutely. And I've been on multiple construction projects, and I watch this. I mean, the car could hold 20 people, 2,300 pound construction workers use that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I would have no problem putting a couple fire companies fully equipped in that elevator and going up. Now,
you mentioned something interesting. To get a paramedic up on one of the upper floors, that you'll use the tower crane. And
yes. We have, she trained on this, and we have been very, very successful in this. Back in the heyday of Las Vegas about 20 years ago, when we had multiple high-rise projects going on simultaneously, we were doing a tower crane rescue about once a week. So the way we operate is technical rescue team. Actually, first company shows up on scene, and they assess the situation. They dispatch the technical rescue team. Technical rescue team shows up, and we immediately make contact with the crane talker. All right, we're escorted right to the project, right to the area, and the crane talker in that situation is the most important person on the ground, because we talk to the crane talker. The crane talker talks to the crane operator. So the crane talker stands with us on the departure point, and then there's another crane talker that's going to be at the arrival point. So they drop the hook right exactly where we need it. We hook up. We have a prepackaged basket with all of our ropes and our spider in it. Hook up two paramedics, or a paramedic and an EMT, hook right into the hook, all right, with the basket, and we put the monitor and the medical bags inside the Stokes basket, and that crane operator lifts us up to the place we need. At whatever point he loses sight of the basket, he passes command, the crane talker passes communication on to the other crane talker, who brings us right exactly to the floor we need. In the meantime, the rest of the company takes the exterior elevator up. So by the time we show up, we expect at least oxygen to be delivered, and at least probably an IV to be delivered. And then the rest of the company shows up, and we actually take care of the packaging. So we will move the patient into the basket, secure the basket, and we will deliver the basket and deliver him back to the crane talker. And we'll have an ambulance on scene by that time, and that crane talker can put that patient right at the back doors of that. We actually put the Stokes basket right on the gurney. So that's a pretty impressive operation. Very, very efficient. But again, don't show up on day one and expect to show up with an injured construction worker and do that operation. It takes a lot of coordination and training with project managers. Because a lot of these crane operators have never done anything like that before. When we show up, we say, we're going to do this. And they say, okay, I've never done it before, but tell me how you want me to do it.
Yeah. What's your experience with it, Enrique?
Yeah, we've had, I don't know, three or four rescues in the career where we haven't used a crane to put the crews in position, but we've used the cranes to bring the victim down with an attendant on the Stokes. So there's always a little bit of discussion, because depending on who the incident commander is, they may not be comfortable with them, but you have to just, you know, explain to them they lift thousands of pounds every day with incredible precision. Lifting a 600-pound rescue load is not going to be a challenge. But yeah, we absolutely. So we've had two tower crane workers succumb to medical conditions where we had to rope them down, only because that was the only option to bring them out of the crane and just do a rope op. But on the sites, on the construction site itself, they're the kings of the construction. They can reach out to almost any point in that structure.
We had one, Enrique, where a crane operated with cardiac issues. And fortunately enough, we had two cranes on the site. We had multiple cranes on the site, but these two cranes overlapped. So we used one crane over top of the other crane and pulled that crane operator off of his crane and dropped him down. That was a pretty impressive operation.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I'm jealous now. I'm jealous. Yeah. So yeah, I haven't met. The only thing we have here is sometimes a language issue, that the construction guys only speak Spanish. So most of us are okay with that.
Crane operators too, Enrique?
Huh?
Crane operators as well only speak Spanish?
Oh, yeah. You can live your whole life in Miami and never have to speak English at all.
Wow. In Las Vegas, the crane operator, the tower crane operator is the highest. That's like the 747 captain, all right? That is the highest level of training and education on any construction site. And I don't know what he makes, but I think he's pushing around $200 an hour when he's on top of that crane operating.
And he make six figures a year, depending on how much, how many jobs they can get to in a year.
Yeah, and he is extremely, extremely talented. As far as the crane talker, the crane operator, we don't ever have problems with no English.
Right. Just a curiosity, Enrique. What do we do with the tower cranes when a hurricane is approaching?
So they auto rotate. They have a small break at the very top. So they'll wind vane into the direction of the wind, and they'll just sit there for the entire. Now they can't collapse after a little while, but even after our last couple of hurricanes, we haven't had any issues. The one in New York collapsed, Superstorm Sandy, when they went over there. Yeah. So what will happen, though, if that break that they have is not set with the right pressure, it will continue to just freely rotate on the mast. So that if you've seen when their technicians show up, they'll climb up inside there with that thing spinning free, and they'll adjust the break at that time. Not something I recommend for the fire service to do.
Hey, what do you know about our new – I just saw an email come out, all stations and offices, about a new application for our pre-fire planning.
Yeah, they just refined it a little bit. So we have a similar system to Fairfax, a computer-based system, but unfortunately it's not tied into our inspections or even to our 302, our HAZMAT program. But it did streamline the ability to get the information, but it is incumbent on the officer at that firehouse to put that information in. So we've done a fairly good job of telling the officers how to put the information and what keywords to use. But at 3 a.m, it's still not pulled up right away by the incident commander. I think it's more of a computer issue, how slow it takes to bring these things up. So now they've just added a Google Earth function where the officers can open up the application and see for their firehouse where the locations are that they need to inspect for that given year. So it just helps them cover more. But last year, I think we did 72,000, something like that, pre-fire plans. It was crazy.
Chief Shaw, do you have a driver, a chauffeur?
Yeah, every day. Yeah, I have a captain.
Nice.
You do?
Yeah.
To help you with IC, to be your eyes and ears?
Uh-huh, yep.
Also, what good is a pre-fire plan on a mobile computer screen if you're having to drive yourself in your vehicle?
Yeah, and that's, I can tell you is when I was a battalion chief, which we don't have aides, that was always a struggle. It's like you're getting there. And fortunately, we're growing. So the battalions are getting smaller and we're able to have our battalion chiefs there quicker. But you're still showing up and you're trying to account for 3 minutes that you were driving to get caught up on the incident. And you can't read the supplements driving down the road. And I can tell you it's a distinct advantage. Like when we're driving down the road, not only do I have a very competent captain I can talk to and say, hey, did you hear that? What are you thinking about what they're doing? But I can just hit this app. I can see the aerial view of the structure. I can see what it's two stories with a basement or whatever it is. And then I can sit and tell my aide, like, all right, when he marks from a scene, his own scene report should say this. If it doesn't, we know what's missing. And
gathering that information again, Chief Dan?
What's that?
Gathers that information?
Oh, it's all in the app. So that app pulls all that information just from public information, like the aerial view, because it automatically zooms in on it. So you're presented with a screen. It's a split screen of your aerial view of the structure, then also what the supplemental information is that we have.
Hey.
But no, it's a huge advantage because not only do I have a longer drive to get there with my aide, but I can listen to the incident. And then, when you come into the mentality, especially the command perspective, that we're really one tribe and I'm there to support you, not take command every time, nor sit there and scorecard you. I can show up and say, hey, look, I know you're engaged. You're deeply engaged. You're trying to get accountability right and get the strategy and tactics. You may have missed these supplemental information. You may have missed this communication, or you didn't see this come through from the call taker to the dispatcher and immediately give them to that. And that's what we're focusing a lot more on, the building of command teams for this purpose. And this large loss fire is one of the things that really got us to look at that perspective of what we inherently do. And I think it's fire service. I'm the incident commander, more chiefs show up, I push them out to divisions and groups. do I need a chief to be in charge of division with an engine and a truck that's doing a defensive operation? Or do I need that chief back here with me at the command post so I can get all two alarms that are coming there and showing up, get a grasp of what our incident is, then I can start pushing out some chief officers to go run groups and divisions, especially in a defensive operation.
Rike, one thing that, that you and I are very proud of about this department is our officer development program.
Yeah.
And an integral part component of our officer development curriculum is building construction. And can you kind of let our viewers know how we do that? Because I think we're kind of unique in that sense.
Sure. So the officer development program here is 4 weeks for lieutenants. And in that portion, they have to have the building construction course, the 40-hour course that you take at your community college before they get promoted. And we do a one-day refresher on building construction, including a site visit to one of our construction sites. And we go over all the stuff we talked about pre-fire for construction, how to operate a construction site. And then they get to see just how a building goes together, a modern structure, and where the fire issues develop when they see it years later on an incident. So it pays off. And then we encourage them to go to the construction sites in their territories and meet the folks that are doing this work and learn as much as they can. I'll offer the course to you guys. I work on Cuban coffee, so it's very low rates. I'll be happy to go to your departments and deliver the course. It's very well received. I only do it because the guy that we had a deputy chief years ago, he also was a structural, and so he passed that endeavor on to me when he retired. But there should be someone in everyone's department who's into construction. It could be someone that's, you know, built a bunch of illegal stuff in their house. It doesn't matter. As long as they have a good understanding of it and they can deliver it from an officer's point of view, what should they worry about? What should they look for? It really can enhance your officer training, whether you do it formalized, like we do in an officer development program, or just in-service training, target solution, which no one loves it, but that's a good component to put some of this information out.
I highly recommend anybody who can to take a class on pre-fire planning, high-rise buildings under construction by one of two guys, retired Chief Mike Turpick from, I believe, Jersey City, and Captain Enrique Pereira.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes, sir, from Miami-Dade.
Thank you.
Are we looking at time here? No, we got 5 minutes. We could solve all of the world's problems, Chief Dan, right now with 5 minutes. So something else, just had another bizarre situation.
Hey, Captain Gustin.
Yeah.
Real quick, in Clark County on pre-fire planning, in Clark County, every fire company, before COVID, every fire company was required to do one pre-fire plan a month. And actually before it was three pre-fire plans a month. Now it's one pre-fire plan a month. And we have a template that we go out and we think it works very well. A lot of guys don't like it because it's just one more thing to do. But it encourages the companies to get out there and walk the buildings in their area. And then we have a class and the information is, what's the roof? What's the building construction? What's the floor construction? What's the fire protection system? Where are the standpipes? Where are the hookups? How many occupants during the day? How many occupants during the night? Is everybody ambulatory? What are we doing in here? Is it commercial? What are we storing? And then what it's required that we take that information back and we get on a certain program that has Earth. And then we have to get a picture, capture a picture, and then we can put icons on the specific picture, and then that's the first page, and then the second page is all the information we've collected. So and it works really well for us. Like I said, some people think it's a pain in the ass, but it works really well for us because it's the companies, it's us that's going to be in that building, and it's us that is collecting that information, and it's the guys that are going to be using that information are actually walking the grounds and collecting that information. So I find it works very, very well, and every time we do it, we turn it into a training session. You know, you meet the people and say, hey, would you mind if I throw a ladder on your building? Would you mind if I pull some hose off? Would you mind if I take some measurements and pull some hose in your building? So we think it works very, very well. And then that's all categorized on the MCT. And when your call comes up, you can hit a tab. And if that particular property has a pre-plan, it comes immediately up.
Mark, within the last 365 days, we've seen the horrific consequences of not knowing what's in your buildings. And I'm not pointing any fingers, laying any blame, because like so many other tragedies, it's just that particular department's luck ran out where ours didn't. But I think we're all well aware of the horrific consequences of not knowing what is in your building. Now, you want the gringo to answer the question about the, because I like Cafe Bustelo, but you like what, Pilon?
Yeah, no, Bustelo is what I had here. Are we allowed to mention brands?
Sure we are, sure.
Well, let me get this up here. Someone asked me what Cuban coffee we use. That's the one. I'll be happy to teach you guys how to make it if you invite me to your departments. I'll even leave all the equipment and the materials behind.
And all over this country.
Well, Chief Dan, I teach in Fairfax probably 3 or 4 times a year. Your recruits, we do the IFF hazmat in their confined space. So I make it at that training facility all the time. I've left 4 or 5 coffee makers and coffee, and so they have fantastic. they have the training. If they haven't invited you, there's something going on there.
Yeah, you're really. It's like you saw our mission, right?
You are cooking classes too. Building construction, coffee, cooking classes. Massages. Oh my gosh, man. I'll have you out to Clark County for sure.
Yeah, the Chief Shaw's been with us on our deployments. We actually have a cash box that's just Cuban coffee. That's all it's in there. So we can't do anything without that stuff. They call it legal crack here.
We go way back. Our relationship with Fairfax County goes way back into the late 80s with guys like Mike Reagan.
That was Armenia, right?
Armenia and Philippines.
Yeah. Hey, Bill, so I think Clark hit something that really is a great opportunity. I don't think I always come back to is our people don't have an unwillingness to train. They just sometimes don't know what to train on or how to train appropriately. And I think when we look at pre-fire building inspections, one of the selling points for a lot of people is just to, you know, focus on that within your area of responsibility. And I think the miss we had was like, you wanted the newest firefighter, because that's usually who got pawned off that document to go walk through the building, to go into a building and think like a chief. What does the chief want? No, we can focus on that. We can build the information. I always try to focus on as a company officer is, hey, look, we run this call, we mitigate the emergency, zero emergency, is it smoke alarm, medical local, whatever it is. Now to capitalize on that pre-fire training, let's focus on what our scope is. You ride the truck. Where can we get ground letters? What's the roof look like? What would a 360 walk around lap look like when we're looking at the structure? What's the rear access ingress to this? If I'm on the engine company, we used to carry, you know, the multicolored carpenter string in 50-foot segments. So we wouldn't go stretch a line every single time, but hey, you hook it up to the rig. Let's estimate the stretch. Whoever's closest, I buy you dinner. Estimate the stretch and get to that back showroom. And so they just stretch out this rope, takes 10 minutes. Now they see where every coupling's gonna lay. They see how long the stretch is. And so you're focusing the pre-fire planning to their area of responsibility, and it's relevant and it means something to them. Versus you tell a brand new guy like, hey, I want you to check what the standpipe is or check where the building systems are, where we shut off the utilities. Yeah, it's not sexy enough for them. It's important, but it's not roping them in. But if you rope them in, then you start building on that. Like, all right, this is why it's so important. We're on the truck. Not only do we cut holes in roofs or force entry, but we're responsible for utilities. Let's go down and see where the utilities are. And you start to, you know, build that learning. And I think it's just more of the way we train and the way we drill, we can build upon that knowledge base so that it's relevant to them.
For instance, if I'm on an engine company and I'm pre-fire planning a building, I want to know if there's a well opening in that stairway. That's huge information.
Yeah, can I use it or not?
Yeah, and we're golden if we have one. Yeah. Is the building conducive to dropping a rope bag, a utility rope, and hoisting a line? And those are the kind of decisions that can be made way before 3 o'clock in the morning with smoke showing. Yeah. So can we all, every one of us, do a better job at pre-fire planning? Sure we can. Should we strive to do that? Yeah. But again, the consequences of not doing pre-fire planning can be horrific. And don't let it happen to your department. I think we're going to wrap this up, fellas. We had a skeleton crew, but Enrique, You are
skeleton crew. This is the A team, Bill.
The A team. Okay.
Not amateur hour.
Right. No. Well, I tell you what, it's not. It really isn't. You got a combined years of a lot of experience here. And again, next month, portable master stream devices. And Enrique, you going to come back?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, tell us something in Spanish.
Buenos dias. Vaya con Dios.
All right, fellas. God bless you. For God's sake, be safe and stay healthy. Until next month.
Pleasure to meet you guys.
Likewise.